On this week's episode of the podcast, I sit down with dentist Aaron Elliott, who's a sleep expert. We'll discuss in this talk, what is sleep apnea and what are other sleep disorders that people should be aware of? We'll talk about the demographics of what to consider with adults and children. We spend some time talking about the different classifications, mild, moderate, and severe, and what that means. We'll spend some time going into the impacts of sleep disorders on your overall health, systemic impact. How does someone know they have a sleep disorder? We do spend a bit of time on sleep studies. I think this is an important part of this talk to actually evaluate the quality of your sleep, to give it a measurable form, to then take that away of when you should treat or not treat a sleep issue. We do spend a little time talking about treatment options and who should treat and how to treat. So what I'd like to hope is that you walk away with a better understanding and appreciation of how we look at sleep, how you could measure your sleep, and when you should intervene with some type of treatment, whether a CPAP, an oral appliance, or some form. So please enjoy, and thank you for listening. We had the pleasure of meeting last year at a lecture here in New York. And so it's a full day lecture on a Friday and made up of a handful of speakers. Aaron and I met somewhere in the hall, started talking and chatting. I'm like, who's this wonderful person, all this energy? And then she gets up and talks about sleep dentistry and sleep medicine. And typically, it's not the most fun, interesting topic for some of us, but the whole room kind of feeds off of Aaron's energy, and she's able to really get to the point, spread knowledge, and give us actionable information of how we can help our patients. So interestingly about Aaron is not only is she a clinician, but she's also an educator. So Aaron goes around the country talking with dentists, helping to educate them around sleep medicine, how to practice it, how to implement it in their practice, and how to treat patients and really how to help people. And so what a better person to sit down and chat with and try to connect with everyone here. Aaron grew up in Southern California. She, like myself, trained in Western New York for her undergrad, and then headed to Creighton Dental School, where she graduated top of her class. After that, she headed to Northern Idaho and practices there with a handful of colleagues. And I guess, Aaron, you could maybe briefly go into the style of practice you have now and let people know kind of what that made up of. And I think right now people are, it's a little blurry in dentistry from practices that purely do sleep medicine to practices that do partly sleep medicine. So I guess you can explain to people kind of who you are from your perspective and what your relationship with patients is.
Well, you are in New York City, so you're used to a specialist or a dentist on every street corner. And in fact, I remember that lecture very clearly because I flew across the country, spoke for 45 minutes, and then came home the next day. And all my friends thought I was crazy, but I thought it was no problem. I'm like, that's that many more people that I get to spread the message to. But I graduated in 2003 and started at Post Falls Family Dental, where I'm currently today, 21 years ago. But when I graduated, it was, here's how you drill and fill, and then here's how you fill out the referral slip to send anything else out that's complicated. You know, we were supposed to do crowns and fillings and an occasional periodontally involved extraction. But it was as I kind of progressed in my career, I found out in about 2008 or 2009 that a dentist could be part of sleep. And so when I it was like a dog on a bone. As soon as I found out, I was like, I am determined to help our patients with this. I did not realize how prevalent it was. I did not realize how skipped over it was and how underdiagnosed. And I also didn't realize how many patients were floating around without a guide, not knowing what to do next when the CPAP didn't work or when they wouldn't even get tested because they knew they would not use the CPAP. And so even by consultants, my partner, everybody, I was told this doesn't work. And so there's something that you don't tell Aaron Elliott to do. If you tell her it's not possible, I will find a way. So I am still a general dentist, and I actually do love doing fillings and crowns. We're a very technology-focused practice with CEREC and cone beam and all of that. But I knew I needed to move beyond dental school dentistry. So not only am I doing sleep, but I've progressed into my implant dentistry. We do short-term ortho on adults. And my partner now, I've been able to shuffle over all the cosmetic stuff and endo, because those are the things I don't enjoy. So I am very blessed to be with the two other dentists that we have, plus an associate, where I get to kind of focus on the dentistry I like to do and sleep. And I will say that I think we have the best patients in the world. We're very relationship focused. Not that every other dental office isn't, but we truly are like a community. We are an important part of this community. And I love that we're kind of in a smaller town where we kind of run into patients everywhere we go and become friends with them. So that's kind of our style per se.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, even from where you are to where I am, kind of the theme of dentistry, right? So we have this relationship with our patients that's profound. And so in prepping for this, I was thinking about kind of like getting how we introduce it to patients and why we have this podcast here. And it comes through the relationship with our patients that we sit down and talking with them about so many different things. And it's funny, I think of some patients who I end up referring to an orthopedic surgeon. And it's like their dentist referring them orthopedic. And we have these relationships with our patients. And that's the basis of why we're talking today. I would say a couple of years ago, I started really paying attention when I had my first child and of my own health and measuring it better. And I think there's nothing more I pay attention to than my sleep. Sleep is the foundation for me and how I start and finish my own health. And now we're having the conversation with our patients so much that it opens up for dentistry to be a really great teammate in our patient's life. I don't know how you find it, but I don't think many patients and people appreciate the prevalence of sleep disorders, right? It's somewhere around 7% of the population. The average household, is it higher even? I started listening to a podcast this morning about safety on the roads and driver safety and how many people are dying annually because of fatigue-related crashes. And this all ties together.
Yeah, unfortunately for drivers, they make it so difficult that if they admit that they think they have sleep apnea, then there's all of this red tape and hoop jumping to prove they're getting treated. So many of them avoid it like crazy. Like they will not even admit they have a problem. So yet, because of the rules and trying to protect the public, they're making it so that people won't get tested at all and making the roads even more unsafe. An appliance is an option as a treatment for CDL, FAA. They're just unaware and uninformed.
So maybe if you can just touch on real quick some of the stats around the prevalence of sleep apnea and sleep disorders in general.
Well, I have to say, because of research, that it's 1 in 4 men, 1 in 10 women, and 50% of the population over the age of 50. So about 20% of the population and more as we age. The issue is, like, at my course, we do about 20 home sleep tests each time. It is probably 60 to 70% of those people. And think about it. These are dentists and team members, health providers that are showing positive for sleep disorders. So across the country, I know it's higher than 20%. Here's the issue, though, is that it presents differently. So many people think sleep apnea is just an old fat man's disease. And so 80 to 90% remain undiagnosed because they don't look, and that's in air quotes for those listeners, they don't look like they have sleep apnea. And when I started in 2008, 2009, there are certain things I look for in the dental anatomy, and we can get into that later. And I would bring up sleep to them and they would look at me like I had two heads. Like, why is my dentist asking about sleep? And now I have people attending my course saying, I have so many patients asking me about sleep that I finally have to come get educated. So the consumer is becoming more educated. And I think that has a lot to do with the Fitbits and iWatches and wearables, and people are tracking their sleep. Unfortunately, I think they're becoming too obsessed with sleep, but that's a whole nother topic too.
Maybe we'll talk about that. Yeah.
But they're at least realizing that sleep is a foundation of total body wellness. The reason I bring this up is because women present as insomnia. And in my mind, insomnia is a form of sleep apnea or sleep disordered breathing until proven otherwise. So for those women who toss and turn or light sleepers, wake up at 1 a.m. and 3 a.m., they're usually clinchers. They usually have a little higher anxiety. They're usually exhausted, not necessarily dozy or sleepy. Those women are suffering and getting overlooked, because if they go to their doctor and say, I can't sleep through the night, they're only given a sleeping pill. And if they do have a physician that's like, you know what, I'm really on top of this, I heard this dental podcast and this girl from Idaho is speaking, I'm going to do a sleep study on this person. Well, they would show mild or underneath that level and show that they have upper airway resistance syndrome. So if you don't know better and you're solely looking at the way the medical world looks at sleep, they're told, oh, you're fine. It's just mild. It's no big deal. So then they go on suffering, when really upper airway resistance syndrome is basically your airway is wanting to shut down, but your body wakes you up before it gets bad enough. So airway closes down, your body shoots out adrenaline or cortisol to keep your airway open. And then you try to sleep and then it does it again over and over and over again. So you're never into that deep, restful sleep. And then they're told they're fine. And it's because their body's keeping their airway open and winning at the cost of good sleep. So that's where my passion really lies. And that's the reason why I fly to New York City for a 45-minute lecture to come back.
Thank you for that. Yeah.
Is because there's so many people suffering that even if they have a good physician, they're still told that they're, in air quotes again, normal, when they are suffering more than the old fat man.
Yeah. So who would you say fit the mold of people with sleep disorders? Who are the patients who fit the demographics, adults and children? I mean, we have two different patient populations that are going through sleep issues that are grossly undiagnosed and untreated. And it's funny you say that, because I have so many patients, and a lot of them are females, that'll come in and say, I was diagnosed with a mild sleep disorder, so I'm okay.
Yeah.
A lot.
I have a joke that if anyone says, oh, you're just mild, I will fly to your office and punch you in the face. I figured that won't offend your New York listeners. No. But it frustrates me, because the way that they measure sleep apnea still 30 years later is so archaic. And even the guy who invented this scale, or AHI it's called, essentially what they're measuring is how many times your airway closes down for 10 seconds or more, and you have a 3% desat in your oxygen. Well, 3% desat in your oxygen is a pretty tall order. Well, then Medicare took it a step further and said, no. Your airway has to close down for 10 seconds and you have to desat 4%. So you have to be sicker in order to qualify. And then all these private insurances say, oh, we're too lazy to really figure this out, so we're just going to follow what Medicare says. So then these people actually get tested and they're told that they're fine, when really you treat the symptoms and the person in your chair and not just that number that is way outdated. So the guy that invented it, you know, they have a scale of normal, mild, moderate, severe. And even the term mild, he regrets, because it's easy to dismiss when the mild patients are oftentimes the most symptomatic. The old fat men that are really, really severe, they tell you they sleep like babies. I don't snore. It's my wife that has the problem with my snoring. I sleep great. And you'll look at their sleep test and they do. They don't move a muscle. They don't wake up. They just sleep. I mean, their oxygen is desatting into the 70s. And it's almost like their body's just like, we don't really care anymore. Whereas like the women and the mild patients are just on alert all the time. We're not going to let that happen. We're not going to let that happen. And so they show up as mild because their airway is not closing long enough or bad enough. So what do we look for? Not feeling refreshed in the morning, waking up in the middle of the night. One of the biggest clues for me is something called nocturia. And that's frequent urination at night. And so many people think it's normal to to get up 2, 3, 4 times to use the restroom because they have a bad prostate, or, you know, ever since I had kids, I have a small bladder, I drink so much water. And really, our bodies should be able to sleep through the night. I give people one time, but anything more than that, I would say is sleep apnea. There's so many symptoms, and each human is so different that you have to listen to the person and not just what some research study said, where they're not even exploring the people that are really suffering.
So with that, I guess we could agree that if it's mild or above, we should consider treating that.
Absolutely.
And so maybe it's worth us just double clicking on what are the impacts of this being untreated from a systemic health issue. I know it leads to fatalities throughout our population. And maybe we can spend a minute just talking about the cardiovascular disease, brain health, weight management, emotional health, relationship issues, and impacts of sleep disorders and sleep apnea. I think it's probably a good thing to spend time on.
You touched on a lot of them right there. And I would also say, even though they're considered normal, if they're symptomatic, we still treat them. The upper airway resistant patient would be kind of like sub sleep apnea, but we still treat them with an appliance. And it's almost like what I tell them is the appliance is going to keep the airway open for you, so you don't have to fight. And your body can finally rest. And I even say it like that, like your body can finally rest. And they go, oh, I want that. So just because they're not bad enough to qualify on the scale, we still offer them treatment. So what can it lead to? Any of your patients that have hypertension or are on a couple medications to control it. I always love when you ask a patient, hey, do you have high blood pressure? And they're like, no. And I say, well, it looks like you're on 2 medications for it. And they say, yeah, that's why I don't have high blood pressure. So, hypertension, the big one now is AFib. So they did a study in which they took like 1,000 AFib patients and did sleep studies on them across the board. Whether they had symptoms or not, they said, you're getting a sleep test. 82.4% of them had obstructive sleep apnea, which is a big number compared to the regular population. And like a third were mild, a third moderate, and a third severe. But one thing I've noticed, cardiologists, you could have 3 heart attacks and they would never mention a sleep study because cardiologists tend to be reactive, not proactive. But if a patient gets diagnosed with AFib, they are on them to get tested and treated. And an appliance is an option. And what they found with AFib patients that if they are treated, the incidence of AFibs goes down below even controls of people that don't have sleep apnea. So that's how effective it is. Congestive heart failure. People with untreated sleep apnea use twice the healthcare dollars. Deep sleep is where our blood sugars regulate. I mentioned cortisol before. That and oxygen deprivation have a role in insulin resistance and glucose intolerance. You talked about a lot of women present with anxiety. Again, that's just that cortisol shoot. Their fight or flight is on alert all night rather than that parasympathetic, resting, relaxing part of our body. So anxiety, REM sleep is where our mood is stabilized, learning and memory is all. And so is emphasized. And so if you're not getting into REM sleep, if you're not getting into deep sleep is also where our brain tissue literally shrinks to sweep out those beta amyloid plaques. So that can lead to dementia, Alzheimer's, trouble losing weight, relationship discord. 35% of married couples are sleeping in separate rooms. Then erectile dysfunction, even though patients don't always talk to us about that, it is a thing. And that nocturia that I was talking about. So many, many issues. And if I just had patients or practitioners, I mean, health hygienists, doctors, dentists, just focus on the top 4. Those top 4 would be hypertension or heart conditions, diabetes, acid reflux, which I forgot to mention, anti-depression and anti-anxiety. The psychiatric drugs are one of the top most prescribed drugs in our country. And I asked a primary care physician friend of mine, I was like, you know what, why don't you do more of finding out why they're having these issues? And he's like, because if patients come in with 10 issues, I have time for three. And if I mention sleep, all of a sudden I'm in charge of this whole other aspect. So, and I said, so if you're saying, if you suspect it and you just refer them to me and I do everything for you, so you have nothing to worry about and follow through, then you'd be more likely to refer. And he's like, yeah. I'm like, okay.
Great. So if a person thinks their spouse or themselves or their child may, or their friend, whomever, may have sleep disorders and sleep apnea, I guess where should they start, right? Sleep studies, and there's a lot of different types, and we'll get into that, I guess, in a moment. What kind of doctor should they seek out, or where should they start with their primary care? Again, we mentioned earlier that in dentistry, it's a little confusing because there'll be sleep doctors or sleep clinics that then pair with certain people to treat. It's a very confusing, at least here in New York. I know some other places in the country, it's the layers of this and the avenues to go to are a little confusing. So where would you recommend someone starting out who may think they have a sleep issue and would benefit from getting more information and possible treatment?
And that's the problem, right? It's so confusing and it's hard. And you're in New York City where it's not easy to get to appointments all that much. And so it's like, okay, I think I have a problem. You go to your primary care, which you usually only see once a year, and you say, hey, I really think I need to get a sleep test. And then they go, oh, no. Look at you. There's no way you have sleep apnea. So then you go on suffering. And then you say, no. You have to become your own advocate. So you have to really want it. And you're like, no, I'm going to go see a sleep physician. And then they say, okay, well, you need a referral from your primary care. We'll see you in 3 months. And then you'll get a sleep test 2 months after that. And then you maybe get a phone call that says, yeah, you have it. You can go get a CPAP. And that's like all you get. So my suggestion is, and yes, I am completely biased because I've been out there in the medical world for 14, 15 years now, is to find a dentist who does this. And I can find a dentist who does this in any area. And you can utilize a third-party telehealth company. The one I use is called sleeptest.com, and patients can even find it themselves. So then you can do telehealth with a sleep physician. They'll order the home sleep test for you, mail it to you, and bill your insurance, and then give you a prescription for the appliance, a letter of medical necessity, everything you need. But more importantly, they do follow up after the sleep study and actually explain what's going on with you. When we do a consult at my office, we do supply our own home sleep tests, and you can in New York. New Jersey is still the only holdout as far as that goes. Mm-hmm. But this third party sleeptest.com kind of takes away that hurdle. But when I go over a sleep study with a patient, their eyes get wide. And after my sleep champion has gone through the consult, they're like, I have learned more in the last half hour than I have throughout this entire journey. And so just listening to the patient and explaining their condition and how it affects them, I mean, I think that's the game changer for these patients to truly not just have this, yeah, I think I may have a problem, to, wow, I really need to do something about this. It's affecting me more than I think. We like to connect the dots to all the other medications they're on or pain points in their life. And I don't think anyone does that better than dentists. Most sleep physicians, and this is a generality, you probably have some really good ones there, but the ones around here anyways are like, oh, rubber stamp, CPAP, rubber stamp, you have mild, just mild, you can go do something if you want to, I guess, and never explaining what their sleep test means to them. So I would say if a patient is like, you know, I think something is going on, I would recommend finding a dentist who does this that can be your quarterback, guide you through the system efficiently, effectively and be able to kind of treat you as the person. And you know what? I'm not just an appliance salesperson, because there's a lot of times that I have a heart to heart. I'm like, you really need to go get CPAP. And by that time, even if they were dead set against CPAP psychologically, when they see the data and it's explained to them, they see the light.
Yeah, I think what you said is the most important part of this, is that someone is going to take the time to go through all the data and sit down with a patient to dissect it and figure out what is the right treatment. I think sometimes in sleep medicine, we find that it's like what you said. It's a little bit of a just a checklist feeling. You did this, you did that, and then you get this, right? You did this, do the results, you get that, and move on. And so I guess patients should really find someone who has the ability to take the time with them to go through the results on what their results are and what are the best treatment avenues given what's going to impact their life and get the right results. So I guess, what is a sleep study measuring that you find is interesting? Because there's a sleep study, they can go to a clinic. People can go, there are home sleep studies. And I guess we should also mention at some point kind of what are the differences between each and what you find the benefits of a sleep study in a sleep lab versus a home sleep study, and why one's preferred over the other, if there is one that's preferred.
In an in-lab study, it's a very accurate picture of an atypical night's sleep. So everyone that goes to the sleep lab says, I do not sleep at all. And I always validate that.
Can you paint the picture for people who have not been to a sleep lab? And I haven't personally gone through that yet, but I have.
I wanted to see what patients went through. So in an in-lab study, you basically go spend the night at the hospital or, a sleep testing place. And they put a bunch of leads on you. So you have leads in your head, along your eye, your chin. You have two different leads that measure your airflow, one that hangs down. And then you have a lead on your heart, a microphone here, and then two belts around your stomach, and then leads on your shin.
It sounds
so
relaxing.
And then it's like, now sleep. And now we're going to watch.
And then there's cameras on you, right? You're in a different bed, everything than home.
Different temperature. Like some people even make the comment, I don't even sleep in pajamas normally, and I had all these clothes on. But it's very accurate. They are literally reading your brain waves, and there's a tech there to make sure everything's working, that nothing goes wrong. What I think it's used for is really severe sleep apnea, really unhealthy people. Like if people have a lot of heart issues, I'm not going to try to treat them in-house or with the telehealth. Like I'm like, you are very unhealthy, unstable. You're going to go see a sleep physician. So that's kind of my cutoff. Honestly, nowadays, they only use those in-lab studies if they have a tough time titrating the CPAP. They'll do an entire night dedicated to CPAP titration, or they'll do what's called a split night. And so if someone is really kind of severe, they spend the first 2 hours proving they have bad enough sleep apnea, and then the rest of the time is getting that CPAP dialed in. So then they only have to go spend the night once. It is, and especially since COVID, it was already doing this before COVID, but everyone has to do a home sleep test first. And then if they're bad enough, then insurance will pay for an in-lab study. Hmm. So with a home sleep test, you have a certain amount of channels that need to, and channels means what data they're collecting. And it's really evolved over the last couple of years specifically, because now they can use something called like plethysomnography or something like that. But they're reading skin capillaries to know whether or not you stop breathing. So it's not just a nasal cannula anymore. There are some that use just something on your finger, sleep image or night owl is an example. There's one that's just two patches on your stomach called Whisper. Watch pad is just your wrist and your finger, but I use kind of an old fashioned one, Metabyte Junior, but it has a cannula, an effort belt. So there's all sorts of varieties. Each one has its pros and cons, whether it be cost or the information you get. And for me, one of the most important pieces of information that you can get is like positional. Like you could be really severe on your back and mild on your side. And that'll give me a hint that you are a good candidate for an appliance. There's a lot of clues within the sleep study to let me know with confidence if this patient I think will respond or if they won't to an appliance. Now, the biggest thing that the point that I make here when I'm lecturing is that a pulse ox is not a sleep study. And so when a patient says, oh, I had a sleep study, said I was fine, my first question is, when? And if they say, oh, it was like 5 years ago, said I was fine, that really means 10 years ago, mm-hmm. as we know.
It's always a double, yeah. It's always a rule of double.
And then I'm a smart aleck, and I say, oh, yeah, I had an eye exam when I was 16. They said I had 20/20 vision, so I haven't had to go back. Right? Like, things don't get better as we get older. So we like to see a sleep study within 1 to 2 years. And then the second question I ask them is it one that you just wore on your finger? Because a pulse ox is only testing pulse and oxygen. And all they're looking for, they don't actually look at the data. All they're looking for is to see if your oxygen dropped below 90. Well, I have example after example after example of moderate to severe patients whose airway closed down 30 times an hour, but their oxygen never went below 90. And so if this doctor said, oh, I did a pulse ox, I'm a good doctor, they're only catching the severes. They're not catching these people that really are suffering. So then this person thinks they're fine and they go on for another 5 to 8 years suffering because they had a test in air quotes and they think they're fine.
Is there a role in cone beam imagery in your practice for this? I know that some practices look at volume of someone's airway visually and use it as a measurement. I'm curious what your thoughts are around that.
You can see my nose crinkle.
Yeah, I saw you were, if you're listening to this, not watching it, Erin's face said no. She said no, it does not.
They're getting there. You can make an assumption, but to me, sleep apnea is not just anatomical, it's physiological too. Meaning you could have a nice wide open airway that collapses like crazy. You could have a skinny airway that's stiff and doesn't collapse. So in my mind, cone beam is used as a talking point. Like when I first started, bringing up sleep was like crazy, right? But with cone beam now, we can say, well, this is why we care. This is something that I noticed, that your tongue posture is low. And you can look from the sagittal view to show their tongue's not filling up the palate. You can show that their airway is small, and it's a talking point. This person's upright and awake. They could be swallowing in the middle of it. It's just a good visual of why we care and what we're looking at. To me, I do use cone beam with sleep, but I'm more looking at the nasal obstructions, deviated septums, polyps, turbinates, abscesses, because their regular general dentist doesn't have this type of technology. So I find pathology. And lastly, the airway. So we can use it as almost like a prop, but I'm using it for other reasons.
I guess that's the important part of this whole talk, is that sleep apnea is not a single metric that we can measure and just diagnose. You have it, you don't, based on this one metric, that it's extremely complicated. Many factors that go into someone having sleep disorder or sleep apnea or not. Like we said, looking at the entire picture of a person and all the different metrics, from their emotional health to the medications they're taking, their heart disease, and then trying to understand if they have things that contribute to having a sleep disorder or vice versa, what the relationship is. I mean, that's the main takeaway for our patients from this talk, is that we really want you to look at what may be contributing to your health or impacting your health around this whole bubble of sleep disorder and how it plays a relationship with your overall health in many different systems.
To me, it's the conversation.
Yeah.
Then you can use all these pieces to connect the dots of how it's affecting their life.
When I started my journey with measuring my own sleep, I started wearing an Oura ring and really looking at what contributed to my sleep. And I now use a different device called a Morpheus, which in the morning measure HRV to correlate how well you slept and different things. Is there anything, because wearable, like you said, are becoming so popular. And I do notice myself, I don't wear my Oura ring religiously. You know, my partner here in the practice, Mark, he wears it religiously and we compare our data a lot. But I find for me, it works better if I wear it sometimes and not all the time because I get obsessed with the metrics, right? If I wake up and I feel great, and then it says I had a bed, like the numbers aren't great, I get really down on myself. Of course, I'll use it the opposite way also. I was talking with a patient who's extremely busy life. She has a newborn child and she was like, I wear it and it makes me feel better because I slept more than I feel like I'm so tired. So I guess what's your takeaway if people are using wearables? Is there any data that's actionable around wearables that they can help assist them with a diagnosis or at least to go down and test it further? What are your thoughts about wearables and sleep disorders?
I think awareness is always good. However, I see the obsession. In fact, there's a new sleep disorder that they've added called orthosomnia, and that's obsession with sleep metrics. And so even after I treat them with an appliance, they'll be like, I stopped breathing one time last night. And I'm like, that is amazing. That's like, perfect. And they just get so obsessed, like, no, really, under 10 an hour is actually our goal. So you're winning. So I'm like, just throw that away and tell me how you feel subjectively. Subjective measurements is actually pretty important. Saying that, for someone that's not treated and they're tracking their sleep, it's great because they start to have good sleep hygiene, meaning they are trying to get a good bedtime routine. They're trying to get enough sleep. They're trying to create an environment for good quality sleep. So those are all good things. But some people have like their night owls, and then all they do is feel bad about themselves when they are not taking the proper actions to try to get themselves to bed earlier. There's a whole system in breaking the night owl routine. And so then they just feel crappy about themselves. So I just think it creates, I don't know, like a bad cycle. However, like you said, to use it occasionally, I totally agree. It's just a check-in. Lastly, they don't tell you what to do about it. Yeah, you had crappy sleep last night. So now I want to get to these manufacturers and say, you had a bad night's sleep. You should contact Dr. Aaron Elliott at Sleep Better Northwest.
Yeah, I guess.
They don't give them any actionable items as to, okay, you had bad sleep. Now what?
I'm talking a lot with my patients about their sleep hygiene. And what we try to do is like pull everything out of that can affect your sleep negatively and then start incorporating thing in from caffeine to behavior to, you know, using their phones at night or whatever it could be. And then trying to isolate. If you're doing everything right and your numbers are still not great, then we have to go a little deeper dive and see what's going on. It's like you said, it's great for sleep hygiene and getting people aware of it. But yeah, I can't wear it every night. It's too hard on myself around it. I guess we should spend a moment talking about appliances because I notice when patients come to me, whether we're making it here in the practice or their sleep team has made it for them, a lot of confusion around the different appliances, even within our profession. Could you do a really quick summary of a CPAP versus an appliance? And we could do a quick just dissection of appliances so people can have an idea what to handle around that before we wrap things up here.
Well, the reason why CPAPs are still so popular, even after all this time, since 2005, oral appliances can be used as first-line therapy in mild to moderate cases in the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, like in the sleep physician's guidelines since 2005. Yet, none of them are still catching on to that. We still only have 5% of the market share. And it's because if you ask them, there's a lot of disinformation or just kind of ignorance. They think there's no medical coverage for oral appliances. And the reason why they probably think that is because a lot of dentists are like, forget medical insurance. It's too hard. We're just going to charge cash. So there is that. Second, they think they don't like that lag time of patient having to get used to the appliance and then kind of dialing it in to try to find the MCE or maximum clinical effectiveness. So they want to know it works as soon as the patient takes it home. So the CPAP indiscriminately just blows air until the airway is open. It's not giving you oxygen. It's just blasting open the airway. And it doesn't care if the patient can handle it or not. It just does that. And so the sleep physicians all think they have 100% compliance with a CPAP, but the reason why they keep prescribing them is because they know they work if they're worn. They kind of forget that part. And then the appliances, trying to find a dentist who knows what they're doing, is billing medical, keeps the doctor informed, like all of the, we're kind of lacking in that area as far as enough dentists doing this. Then to top it all off, to be compliant with CPAP, you only have to wear it 4 hours a night, four nights a week. Like they lower the bar. I always tease that. I'm like, yeah, I got 70% of your decay out. We're good. That's standard of care. So even then, they still only have 60% compliance rate. And that's if the patient even goes and gets it, because so many just give up because that whole referral pathway is so difficult.
Yeah, it's very friction heavy.
Once you get a physician that is appliance friendly, oh, I was going to say too, there's a huge recall on CPAPs. There's two main CPAP makers, ResMed and Philips, has this huge issue. It is one of the worst fiascos of this century of just commercial company with causing lung cancer. The magnets are affecting pacemakers. They just decided to give up altogether. There's a chip shortage. So CPAPs are like 8 months out. It's like, you have this deadly disease. Now wait. So oral appliances could really fill in the gaps here. And even then, they still don't catch on. So that's when I'm like, I'm just going to take matters into my own hands. I reach out to primary care physicians, mid-level providers, functional medicine, like so many other people besides sleep physicians refer to me. With oral appliances, there's over 100 different types out there. Every person thinks that their invention is the best appliance for everybody. But the way that I look at it, it has to be digital. Gone are the days of salt and pepper acrylic. We should not be using that, because in order to make a strong appliance with salt and pepper acrylic, you have to make it bulky. So digitally designed with new material. The second is that it has to have a 3-year warranty, because insurance covers every 3 to 5 years. So I want peace of mind that our patients are taken care of. And not only that, I judge everything by chairside time. So yeah, my lab fee might be a little higher, but then I'm not dealing with people coming in with fractured and broken appliances and frustrated patients who are, and the elastics are wearing out and, you know, it's cheap, it's breaking, it's uncomfortable. So I would rather spend a little more on the front end to avoid all the hassle on the back end. And then the third is I work with 3 different companies. I try to pare it down based on the patient's anatomy. One of the biggest things that I look at is their wear pattern. Their wear pattern is telling us something. Do they have a forward wear pattern, side to side? And yes, when we treat the airway, I suspect that some of the bruxing events will go down. One study showed 48%, but that's not 100%, right? So we want to give them the freedom of movement to what they're used to doing. And so I'll base it off of that. And then the last thing, unfortunately, is medical insurance. They dictate to us which appliance we're allowed to make. And that is why I'm running for Congress, because I can sit here and whine, or I can do something about it.
Fix the dental and medical insurance. thanks. Please do that.
That's my goal. That's my platform.
Yeah, me too. I think about that a lot. And so the appliance is worn on the upper lower teeth and it protrudes the lower jaw, opening the airway. And so
it postures the jaw forward for patients to prevent the collapsing of the tongue. But I have this beautiful video. It's an endoscopic view of someone asleep in a drug-induced sleep endoscopy and airway collapsing. You can hear the snoring and the vibration of the uvula. And then you can see when the jaw is brought forward that the airway opens volumetrically. It's beautiful.
We'll put the video at the end of this. So if you just watch through the end, because we're wrapping it up now anyway, and people can witness what's actually happening. Erin, I know you have to start your day now and treat patients all day. So I guess if there's anything else other than that, we can kind of wrap it up now.
I think we should do a second part in case there's questions. Yeah. And then we can just have...
Yeah, before we started this, Erin and I, we had a hefty list of things and goals we wanted to touch on today. So we kind of got through most of it, but I think there's some loose ends here that we need to tie up. So thank you so much. And anyone can, you can find Erin online. She has a nice social media, her website, her practice. So, and let us know if you have questions, just follow up with us and we'll come meet again and go a little deeper. Thank you so much for your time and for everything you're giving everyone.
Thank you.
Patients and fellow doctors and all of us. Thank you for you.
Well, goodbye and thank you from Idaho.
All right. See you from New York. Thank you for joining us this week. I hope you found it helpful and enjoyable. Please head to our website for our show notes and more information around the topics we discussed today. Please check us out on our YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok pages for weekly updates and other interesting topics we discuss more frequently. The information provided in this podcast is for general information and educational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional advice. Accordingly, before taking any actions based on such information, we encourage you to consult with the appropriate professionals. We do not provide any medical nor health advice. You should seek the full diagnosis and treatment from your healthcare providers for any issues or conditions you may have. No doctor and patient relationship is formed. The use or reliance of any information used from this podcast is solely at your own risk. This podcast is purely for educational and informative purposes only.